Hey everyone, this is Pastor Dane Johansson from Agros Reformed Baptist Church in Gilbert, Arizona. I want to take a few moments tonight to read a few things with you guys. First, from the Apostle Paul's first letter to the Corinthians in chapter 13, when he talks about charity, a word that you'd have to look up in the King James. Unfortunately, it's so hard. You have to look it up and realize that charity meant love here. In verse 4, he says, verse 3, let's start there. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, and have not charity, it profiteth me nothing. Charity suffereth long and is kind. Charity envieth not. Charity vaunteth not itself. It is not puffed up. Doth not behave itself unseemingly. Seeketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil, rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in the truth, beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. Charity never faileth, but where there be prophecies, they shall fail. Whether there be tongues, they shall cease. Whether there be knowledge, it shall vanish away. That's an important list of descriptors of what love is biblically. And when we compare that with the fruits of the Spirit in Galatians 5, we have a good idea of the kind of love that God has towards us and the kind of spirit that we are to have as Christians that God puts within us when he regenerates us and we are saved. What's interesting in that list in 1 Corinthians, as well as the fruit of the Spirit, the different aspects of that fruit of the Spirit listed in Galatians 5, is that niceness is not on that list. And the reason I bring this up is because I wanted to read an article published by Reverend Taylor DeSoto on May 1st. It's in his series on his Young Textless and Reformed blog. If you go to youngtextlessreformed.com, you will see a large collection of articles that Taylor has written. He is currently engaged in writing a series reviewing Dr. Mark Ward's book, Authorized, The Use and Misuse of the King James Bible. This is a review of Chapter 5, which Taylor has titled this article, Authorized Review, Chapter 5, The KJV as a Second Language. Now, that seems racy or kind of like he's poking or making a jab, but that's actually not at all what's going on. A lot of these men who are engaged in attacking the KJV are actually proposing to a thinking populace that the King James Version of the Bible, the authorized version of the Bible, is in fact a foreign language to modern readers. So the reason I brought up the attributes of love, of charity, the attributes of the fruit of the Spirit, is and talking about niceness, is because niceness is something that Mark Ward seems to really, really push forward. And as we'll see in Reverend Taylor's article, he touches on this a bit, though he doesn't use the word niceness. The fact of the matter is that Mark Ward has put himself forward as nice time and time again. And being nice is great. It's a nice thing to be nice. It's a nice thing to have people be nice to you, but niceness is not a fruit of the Spirit. Niceness is not an attribute of love. I know many people that will nicely stab you in the back. I know many people who are nice that are atheists. I think probably the nicest person I've ever met was an atheist. And some of the least nice people in history have been faithful, Bible-believing, gospel-preaching Christians. I don't know, let's take Luther. Not a nice guy. Many of the reformers. But if you want to take Luther off, he's kind of weird anyway. Calvin, not very nice. You read his Institutes, the language he uses about his opponents, especially in the section on justification, not a nice guy. That doesn't mean anything, though, spiritually. That doesn't mean anything from a Christian standpoint, whether you're nice or not. But as I think any reader who just really tries to read not just the rhetoric that's being said but read between the lines of what's actually being said with Mark Ward's book or Mark Ward's videos. Nice means nothing when what he's doing is not nice at all. It's not charitable. It's not loving. It's not kind. It's not patient. It exalts itself. It is not putting forward a humble and charitable spirit whatsoever. In fact, it's divisive. And so that's why I bring that up, and we'll look at it. I don't want to waste too much time here. I just want to make sure that this article gets a little bit wider attention. That's my intention in putting it out here. I encourage you to read this whole series that Taylor is producing on reviewing chapter by chapter Mark Ward's book, Authorize the Use and Misuse of the King James Bible. So anyway, let's get into it. I'll make some comments as we go along. It says, this article is the sixth in a series reviewing Authorize the Use and Misuse of the King James Bible. Introduction. In chapter 5 of Authorized, the Use and Misuse of the King James Bible, Ward finally says clearly what has been lurking in between the lines in the first four chapters, that the KJV should not be read. See this syllogism he provides on page 79. So this is from page 79. He lists out three things. Number one, we should read the scripture in our own language. Indeed, as a confessional Christian, a son of the Reformation, I agree that scripture should be in the vernacular tongue. That people should be able to read the language for the Bible for themselves without having to learn Latin or the original languages of Greek and Hebrew. But they should be able to never have to think a single Greek word, a single Hebrew word, single Latin word, Aramaic word, Syriac word, etc., and be able to just read their Bible in their own mother tongue without ever having to worry about it. I agree. Secondly, the KJV is not in our language. So he says we need to read the scripture in our own language. Number two, the KJV is not in our language. Number three, therefore, we should update the KJV to be in our language, or we should read vernacular translations. So, again, the niceness, because, you know, up till this point, if you read Reverend DeSoto's other review articles, he's been funny. He's been, you know, seems really humble and nice and coming off so nice, so funny, talking about his own shortcomings and learning his own shortcomings and being able to pick up girls and yada, yada, yada. But now we come to what he's actually saying. He's now couched everything, the previous chapters up to this. It's nice, it's funny, it's lighthearted. Now we get to this. Therefore, we should update the KJV into our own language because it's not in our own language, or we should read vernacular translations. So what he's saying there is that the KJV is not a vernacular translation. Thus, anyone who reads it and thinks they can read it is either deceived, lying, or dumb. Doesn't even realize they're not understanding what they're reading. He concludes with this. Taylor says, and gives another quote from page 85. This is Ward. I therefore do not think the KJV is sufficiently readable to be relied upon as a person's only or main translation, or a church's or Christian school's only or main translation. If you have the KJV, shouldn't have it as your main translation. You should be reading something else alongside of it. Get a parallel Bible that has the KJV, the NIV, NLT, ESV, all of it. You can just read them all. You can't just have it as your own main translation or only translation. Well, I guess that cuts me out of the picture. I guess that cuts the majority of my church members who are in their 20s out of the picture, and it cuts our church out of the picture because that's the only translation we use for preaching, reading, and teaching. Ward, this is Taylor continuing, Ward arrives at this conclusion by building a case that the KJV is, quote, no longer a vernacular translation, end quote, and makes use of Glenn G. Scorgi to seemingly say that the KJV is, quote, not really a translation, end quote, page 85. He, Ward, like many opponents of the KJV, makes comparisons between the KJV and the Latin Vulgate, page 62, and notes that the translators of the KJV were, quote, not King James only, end quote, page 83. It shouldn't need to be said, but I want to remind my reader that the difference between Latin and the vernacular tongue of the people during the time of the Vulgate is not even comparable to the difference between KJV English and modern vernacular English. Taylor's talking about the time of the Reformation when there wasn't really vernacular translations, and those that did exist were fragmentary, only parts of the Bible, and were not widely used or widely available. At that time, the church had control, the papacy and the cardinals, the priests, they were the only ones that could even read it, because they were the only ones educated to read, really, and they read it in Latin, and no one else could even read it. Latin was a language spoken by the elite, by the educated, in universities, monasteries, in mass, in church. It was not a language people spoke on a daily basis, the average person. It's kind of hard for us to even imagine there's this language that people speak, a good amount of people speaking it, but your average person could not understand it. So he's saying that it shouldn't even have to be mentioned, that drawing the parallel between the King James and the Latin Vulgate in the time of the Reformation is on its face absurd, because that's a completely different context entirely. We're talking about a language no one spoke. In Germany, they, you know, your average blacksmith in Germany and his family were not speaking Latin. They were speaking German. So not an accurate parallel is Taylor's point there. I agree. He continues, "It is also unfortunate that Ward and many apologists for modern Bible versions continue to compare their assault on the KJV to what happened during the Reformation. More importantly, Ward's reader should be noticing the ramped-up rhetoric of this chapter." It's indeed true. That's what he does. He draws you in with niceness, and after he's drawn you in with his niceness, then he can stab you in the neck. He employs many of the anti-KJV arguments, such as, quote, "the KJV translators wouldn't believe what you do," end quote, argument. The KJV translators wouldn't believe that the KJV is readable. I mean, let's just think about that for a minute. I believe the KJV Bible is easily understood to the average English reader. The KJV translators would disagree with that. I don't even think that needs a comment. "This chapter is possibly," Taylor continues, "the most helpful to understanding the goal of Ward's work thus far. In my opinion, it would have served well as the opening chapter." I agree. Because he actually lays out his cards here. Taylor continues, "He reveals most clearly what he has been getting at up to this point, that the KJV as it exists now should not be read any longer. This is persuasive writing, and now the objective has become clear, to convince people not to read the KJV. That's his goal. That's what he's trying to persuade people to do. And as Taylor has pointed out, in earlier articles, it seems that his audience is those who don't read the King James anyway. So he's trying to persuade non-KJV readers how unintelligible the KJV is and how it can't be and should not be read as one's primary or only Bible translation. Reverend DeSoto continues, "Many people mistakenly label Ward as, quote, a KJV advocate, end quote, or that Ward, quote, loves the KJV, end quote. And this chapter demonstrates clearly why this is simply not true." Ward has said that over, "Oh, I love the KJV. You know, someone who grew up on the KJV, enjoys it, memorized it, loved it, came to faith through it. I love the KJV." And then attacks the KJV. Says that it shouldn't be read. So, very strange. Mark Ward's solution to the 55% of the Bible readers is that, number one, the KJV should be updated, or that they, number two, should read a modern translation. So for us who read the King James as their primary Bible, lots of Reformed men that are TR or just like the King James, Joel Beakey, so let's just put Joel Beakey in here, Dr. Joel Beakey of Puritan Reformed Seminary, who published the Reformation Heritage KJV Study Bible, arguably the best study Bible in the modern market, period. Ward's advice to him is that he needs to either update the KJV, which he kind of did in his notes, or read a different translation, a modern translation. So Joel Beakey, the Reformation, the Heritage Netherlands Reformed denomination, whatever his denomination is, sorry, I forgot, they need to ditch the KJV, or they need to update it. Okay, He argues that, this is Taylor continuing on, Ward argues that a, quote, KJV with tons of footnotes offering contemporary equivalents of archaic words is not enough, end quote. Now, this is important, and this is his persuasive writing the best, and Taylor will go into this in a minute. You know, here's a TBS Windsor Bible I have in front of me. In the back, this is just a text-only Bible. Just text, nothing else in it. In the back, they have a Bible word list defining all of the KJV hard words. In the Westminster Reference Bible that the TBS also puts out, they put that list in the margin itself. So as you're reading, it's right there. Most King James Bibles, if you have a reference Bible especially, will have these updated words for you, these glosses, footnotes offering contemporary equivalents. Ward is now saying that's not enough. That's not going to cut it. You need to either revise the whole thing completely or ditch it. That is the only way moving forward. Taylor continues, interestingly, Ward argues in this chapter that the KJV is not written in the same language as contemporary vernacular English. Wow, strange. Now, I agree with Ward, Taylor says, that the KJV is not written in our colloquial way of speaking. That's true. I don't think anyone would argue that it is. The confusing part of this logic is how you go from the KJV being different from our vernacular English and the KJV being an entirely different language. Meaning, you know, if I were to hand a non-Spanish speaker, an English speaker, a Spanish Bible, and have, you know, 15 glosses per page of definitions of words into English, they still would not be able to make heads or tails out of the Spanish Bible, obviously. They don't speak Spanish, so 15 words or some glosses on the side for the hard words are not going to help them. Ward's argument is the same thing. The KJV is in such a different language. It is a different language that even some, you know, marginal glosses won't help. I think the reason Reverend DeSoto is going kind of harsh on him and why I am in this video and kind of I'm mocking, which again, that's not nice, so you shouldn't do it. I am mocking right now. I'm being sarcastic. Is because this is unacceptable for a guy who has a doctorate, a self-professed language nerd, to be behaving this way and writing this way and being deceitful. It's unacceptable. So, I mean, if I see this kind of mockery towards us, his readers, I'm going to mock right back. He continues on. KJV being an entirely different language. Typically, Taylor writes, it is recognized that literary English and vernacular English are different. The argument that the KJV is literally a different language mimics the thought of Dr. Andrew Nocelli, who says, quote, I was raised on the King James Version, so I'm bilingual. I can speak KJV. The KJV was an outstanding translation for its time, but today, over 400 years after its first release in 1611, I think it belongs in a museum, end quote. How to Understand and Apply the New Testament, page 42. Dr. Andrew Nocelli said that. Wow. Yeah, the KJV is not in our colloquial daily English. Most words, most books we read will not be. John Piper's books are not going to be either. Your average, you know, Christian book is not going to be in your colloquial everyday English. You only use about 3,000 words a day at most in the English language. We have a very small vocabulary as far as what we speak on a daily basis. We speak in different ways. Even as I'm reading this article, written English, it is not how we speak. It's not how I'm speaking right now. There's a difference between how I am speaking right now and how this article is written. It's not the same kind of syntax. It's not the same kind of grammar. It's different. It's written English versus spoken English. Both are contemporary English that I'm reading and speaking right now, but it's different. So their argument that the King James is a different language, that if they can read the King James Bible fluently, then they're bilingual. I mean, where do we go from here? Like, brothers, where do we go from here? What are we supposed to do now? What now? Really? What now? I mean, there's no. That's not charitable. That's not. Because if you're trying to be charitable, you'd be trying to have a conversation. That's not having a conversation. That's not having a conversation at all. Oh, well, it's a different language. Really? Really? What do you even say to that? I will refrain from trying to think of something to say and just continue reading Reverend DeSoto's article. So the next section is responding to the vernacular argument. In chapter 5, Ward presents what seems to be the purpose of writing authorized, and primarily builds his argument upon the claim that the KJV is no longer vernacular English and therefore should not be read. He provides a definition of vernacular from the New Oxford American Dictionary as a starting point for his argument. This is the dictionary definition for vernacular. Quote, it refers to language spoken as one's mother tongue, not learned or imposed as a second language, end quote. Taylor continues, is this the argument then, that the KJV is not English? Are KJV readers bilingual? He seems to be leaning on the first part of the definition, which indicates that the language must be spoken. Since people do not speak KJV English, then it apparently qualifies as a second language. I mean, at our church, from the pulpit, I pray in the King's English. I use ETH at the end of verbs. I, you know, decline, conjugate verbs when speaking to God in a different way than I do normally. I address God, thee, thou, thine, because he's one. He's not you. He's not plural. I mean, I don't make a big deal about that if other people want to pray in there and use you or whatever, but I prefer to do it that way. When I'm preaching, sometimes I even go into, you know, thou dear Christian and stuff, just because I'm reading the Puritans all the time. I'm reading the King James all the time. So, but I mean, yeah, sure. As a general rule, even me, who's kind of a weirdo and extreme with this, as far as I'm liking to do this, no, people don't speak King James English on a daily basis, but that doesn't make it different. Rabbit hole. Let's continue on. It must be spoken, is Ward's argument, Taylor's saying. Since people do not speak KJV English, then it apparently qualifies as a second language. He continues on, hinting that the KJV cannot be understood and that it is Elizabethan English, which is untrue on both accounts. It isn't Elizabethan English. Elizabethan English would be Shakespeare, John Donne, Milton kind of falls into that as well. Who's the guy that wrote The Temple? George Herbert. George Herbert would be Elizabethan English. KJV is not written in Elizabethan English. Continuing on, he says, it is demonstrably different than Elizabethan English and can be understood, as Ward has admitted all throughout his book. The basic argument seems to be that since we do not use the syntax and exact vocabulary of the KJV in our daily speech, that it is no longer acceptable as a translation. So that seems to be his argument, which that can be your argument if you want, but at least finally we know what he's trying to do here. Taylor continues, this is a fundamental flaw in Ward's argument. Simply because modern English speakers do not speak in the King's English does not mean they cannot understand the King's English. He uses Luke 14 to demonstrate that the KJV is written in a way that we do not speak any longer. Yet I fail to see how this is relevant at all. Let's take a look at verse 1. So Ward brings this up. He says, let's look at Luke 14:1, KJV. And it came to pass, as he went into the house of one of the chief Pharisees to eat bread on the Sabbath day, that they watched him. Taylor says, it is true that we do not say, and it came to pass, in our daily speech. But does that mean we cannot understand what that means? We don't use the term eat bread to mean mealtime, but we do say break bread to mean the same thing. Yeah, this is a very strange direction that Ward goes here. I mean, this is, you know, the false friends argument is way better than this. This is, and it came to pass? We're really going to say, and it came to pass is not understandable to an English reader? Give that to any person in context, and they'll know what "and it came to pass" means. or eat bread, meaning mealtime. Yeah, we don't say that, but we say break bread all the time. Taylor's right. People say that all the time. Let's break bread. That's a very common thing people say all the time. I don't know what, like, where are we, what are we talking about here? Taylor continues, the question that needs to be answered is not, is the KJV vernacular English? It is, can the English of the KJV be understood? Exactly. That's what needs to be asked and what needs to be answered. It's not a matter of if the KJV is vernacular English, is because if by vernacular we mean contemporary colloquial conversational English, no, of course not. But neither is, again, Tolkien's writings. Neither C.S. Lewis's, The Chronicles of Narnia. Neither is Harry Potter. Neither is a newspaper. Neither is, basically any kind of literature is not colloquial, everyday spoken conversational English. It's going to be at different levels, closer or farther away from that, of course, but it's not. So the real question is not, is it vernacular English, but can the English of the KJV be understood? Taylor continues, more importantly, Ward fails to comment on the fact that our daily speech is not typically narrative. It is conversational. Most of what we say is not structured like the genres found in the Bible in any translation. The genre of Luke is not conversational, it is narrative. The phrase, and it came to pass, is found in all sorts of modern literature, including the writings of J.R.R. Tolkien. So there, that was Taylor's words, exactly true. He continues, Ward is actually arguing that if a Bible translation is not written in our conversational English, it must be updated or retired. The ESV does not pass this test either. What's interesting is that Mark Ward's book, ESV readers should be up in arms about this, because it should also say, authorize the use and misuse of the ESV Bible. Or standardized the use and misuse of the English Standard Version, because most of these arguments go right at the ESV as well. The ESV is not written in colloquial English. Taylor gives an example. He says, the ESV does not pass this test either. Take, for example, Matthew 12:44. I will return to my house from which I came. That's from the ESV. No one says that. No one says that. I'm going to go home. No one says, I will now return to my house from which I came. All right, well, let's retire the ESV. It needs to just be in the dumbest possible language, the most simplistic, hey, bro, I'm heading home. That's what our Bible should read as. Taylor continues, nobody talks like that in a normal conversation. Yet we do not say it is unintelligible. The point is that written English is different from spoken English. And this is true in a multitude of languages. It's usually a much more drastic departure in other languages than it is for English speakers and English countries. Like, for example, a lot of places will have like the written form of the language and the spoken form. And when you write the language, it has to have these kinds of, it'll have different verb conjugations, it'll have different syntax. It's almost like a dialect of the language itself. Like, for years and years and years, up until the 70s, in Greece or Cyprus or any of the Greek-speaking countries, there was what was called the Demotiki, the dialect of the people, and then the Katharevousa, the pure language, which was the literary language. So all diplomatic talks were given in Katharevousa, all books were written in Katharevousa, anything literary was written in Katharevousa or spoken in Katharevousa. In fact, I have a prayer book from the Greek Orthodox Church over there that's a English and Greek diglot, and it's in straight Kini Greek. It's not even in the Katharevousa or anything, but as an example here too, I have the Vamvas, late 1800s translation of the Greek Bible, both the Old Testament and the New, so the translation from the Masoretic text and then the updating of the TR into Katharevousa, and this is still widely used in Greeks and Cyprus. They'll also just read the TR because they can understand Kini Greek no problem, but and Katharevousa is basically Kini Greek. It's really, really similar, and the Demotiki is the language of the people, what they speak on the street day by day. My point in saying all that is that many languages have a very distinct form of their written form of the language and the spoken form of the language. Telugu has the same thing. There's a ton of languages that have this. English does not. So we come into these contexts and we're almost like, you know, we're kind of lost. And actually, at the time of the King James, it appears that there was a much more of that same kind of thing, where there was the written English, spoken English, written English, spoken English. So it seems that there might have been more so of that. I haven't studied the history of English linguistics to that degree to be able to speak authoritatively or not. But Taylor's point here is that the ESV then needs to be tossed out, because it says, "I will return to my house from which I came," which is not, that's not understandable. That's not vernacular. So better toss the ESV out too. And his Taylor's point is that we need to, you know, remember that written English is different from spoken English, even though there's not the same kind of distinctive, you know, split in English as there is in other languages. Still, written English is much different than spoken English. Another example I always like to point people to is this. So if you go to Luke 9:44, I'll start in the King James. Luke 9:44. Jesus is talking about different parables. He says this, let these sayings sink down into your ears, for the Son of Man shall be delivered into the hands of men. That's the King James. Now, let these sayings sink down into your ears. What does that mean? I mean, that's a weird way of talking. That's not English. That's literally not English at all. Those are English words for Greek words. That's what the Greek says. Let these sayings sink down into your ears. That's what it says in Greek. They literally translate right there. They didn't even attempt to bring it into English at all. The King James didn't. So let's retire that. That's not how we speak. In fact, that's never how any English people spoke. Ah, but let's go to the ESV and see how they do it. How does the ESV translate Luke 9:44? Let's see. ESV, Jesus says, let these words sink into your ears. The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men. So the ESV followed the King James. Then it needs to be checked too. That's not how we speak. That's not vernacular. Give me a translation I understand. Give me a translation in my language, please. Because that's literally what the Greek says. Theste imis ista ota imon tus logos tutus. That's what the Greek says. There's no variant there or anything. It's what the Greek says. Theste imis ista ota imon tus logos tutus. That's what the Greek says. Let these words sink into your ears. Let these sayings sink into your ears. Here's what the NIV renders it as. Luke 9:44. Listen carefully to what I'm about to tell you. That's English. ESV, KJV were not English, technically. That was biblical English, as the Trinitarian Bible Society likes to say. I think we need to remember that the Bible, biblical translation, the King James Bible, that's biblical English. It was never colloquial English. It was never vernacular English, if by vernacular you mean colloquial. It was completely understandable, but they were taking Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek texts, Greek books, Greek language documents, Hebrew language documents, Aramaic language documents, and translating them into the English language, and what they came out with was biblical English. And so I guess the ESV also retained some of that. So if we're going to be arguing that it should just be completely understandable and in vernacular English, the ESV does not pass the test, because the ESV oftentimes has very strange biblical English, just like the King James does. But that doesn't mean we don't understand it. It's not unintelligible. We understand what that means. But this is where it gets really weird. And Taylor comments on this as well. He says, Ward adds another strange layer to his argument by saying that God didn't originally speak in KJV English, but he did speak in modern version English. Those are not Ward's literal words, but that's what he's implying. This is a quote from page 79 from Ward. He says, God did not say, thou shalt not commit adultery. He said, you shall not commit adultery. He didn't say, of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat. He said, you are free to eat from any tree in the garden. The KJV and modern translations are saying precisely the same thing, of course, but they're speaking to different audiences, and only one of those audiences is still living. The weirdest thing here is that he's completely wrong. God did not say, thou shalt not commit adultery, which is the King James. And then Ward says, he said, you shall not commit adultery. Actually, if we're going to be, you know, nerdy language guys, he did say thou. He didn't say you, he said thou, because it was singular. It was a singular imperative. Speaking to Adam, you shall not. So singular, you. Our modern vernacular English does not, colloquial English does not make a differentiation between second person plural and second person singular, whereas King James English does. Thou, thee, you, ye, that's a difference in singular, plural. T, anything with a T, singular. Anything with a U or a Y is plural. So actually, he's completely wrong on two accounts, because if we're going to actually translate it, it is thou and not you. Also, he didn't say anything in English. It was in Hebrew. It was in Greek. It was in Aramaic. He never spoke anything in English. And Taylor goes on to talk about this as well. He says, setting aside the fact that nobody says you shall do this or that in vernacular English. Sorry, NIV, ESV, and NASB, you guys need an update. Notice that Ward says, quote, the KJV and modern translations are saying precisely the same thing, end quote. Taylor continues, I want to further emphasize that English did not exist at the time. Sorry, I keep laughing. I want to further emphasize that English did not exist at the time of the writing of the Bible. If the statements both mean the same thing and God did not speak originally to the people of God in English, what is Ward even trying to say here? I'm at a loss as well, Taylor. This is arguably one of the most confused statements in the entirety of the whole book so far. Agreed. Ward presents his argument convincingly enough, but it fails the test of common sense. Very true. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of phrases in every translation that are written in a way that we do not speak in our daily vernacular, because it's biblical English, and all the other modern versions are mostly just copying the KJV. We do not say, quote, you shall not, or to you it has been given. The simple response to Ward's entire argument is this. Does anybody actually expect the Bible to sound exactly like our vernacular speech? Does anybody want the Bible to sound exactly like the daily speech? No, you don't, because then it would be capturing what the Bible is saying. It would be, read the NLT and tell me that that's what you want your Bible to sound like. I mean, some of these guys say they do. But that it's missing. You can't take a document that's written at, you know, a whatever level, let's just say 10th grade level, reading level, and then translate it into a 5th grade reading level. If you do that, you will, by definition, be losing meaning. So nobody wants the Bible to sound exactly like their daily speech. The argument that the KJV is an entirely different language is nothing but rhetoric. Very true. And it should even be apparent to the reader that Ward has disproved that in the pages of his own book. That's very, very true. This whole idea that the KJV is not vernacular is absurd. It's not colloquial. It's not contemporary. That doesn't mean it's not vernacular. For it not to be vernacular would mean it would have to be in a different language. So they literally do this. They literally then argue that it's in a different language. I mean, again, in a previous video I had on Mark Ward, I said that he's just insulting. He is. You know, Dr. Ward, if you somehow ever watch these videos I make, where I'm talking about you, you know, brother, like, you're disrespectful, man. You are disrespectful. You are just, it's insulting. You're insulting to the average person. It seems as though, I don't even know. I don't even know what to say. It's just really strange you go that route. Conclusion, this is Taylor. One of the most challenging parts of reviewing this chapter of Authorized is the slew of disconnected thoughts and arguments. His reader has been told so far that the KJV is readable, that the false friends, quote-unquote, don't affect doctrine, and that most people read the KJV, meaning 55% of people. Now, we are finally presented with Ward's actual argument, that because people don't talk in KJV English, it is not a suitable translation. An important reality that Ward seems to miss here is that written language and spoken language evolve separately and are used differently. In writing, there are genres that employ different syntax and vocabulary than the syntax and vocabulary of our spoken language. In fact, vernacular English is often categorized into its own genre distinct from literary English. In other words, we talk differently than we write. While Ward's demand for Bibles to be written in our daily vernacular is strange and misguided, he also uses this chapter to take quick jabs at the KJV by referencing non-related issues such as textual criticism and modern translation methodology. He even takes some time to address the KJV-only crowd. He ends the chapter with conflicted he ends the chapter with conflicted messaging once again. Quote, this is pages 85 and 86. This is Ward. Quote, in countless places, the KJV does not fail to communicate God's words to modern readers. I'm eager to acknowledge this fact because I grew up on the KJV and it was God's tool to bring me to new life. Wow, that's amazing. But, he says, in countless places it does fail through no fault of the KJV translators or of us. It's somewhere between Beowulf and the English of today. Let me finish and then I'll come back and, wow. It's somewhere between Beowulf and the English of today. I therefore do not think the KJV is sufficiently readable to be relied upon as a person's only or main translation, or as a church's or Christian school's only or main translation. Thankfully, we don't have to give up everything we valued in the KJV in order to gain the readability benefits of newer translations. The best way to honor the translation and revision work of the KJV translators is to allow it to continue, meaning just keep making new ones, revise it, make new translations. That sentence, how did the man write that? It's almost like robbery. I feel like the person who pays $6 or whatever for this book should get, like, you're paying $6 to have somebody tell you that the King James Bible is somewhere between Beowulf and the English of today. Beowulf. I'll say it again, Beowulf. This is the Anglo-Saxon. That's what, when people say Old English, the King James is not an Old English. Old English is a different language. It's the earliest form of English, if you could even call it that. It's where we can kind of trace some of where our English came from. It's Anglo-Saxon, Beowulf. One of the most famous, you know, Anglo-Saxon epics. One of the earliest forms of what would, I guess you could say, become what we speak today as English. Beowulf. So what's it, what's actually in between Beowulf and the KJV as far as English language development? As far as literary value would be Wycliffe's translation or Chaucer. Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. That's Middle English. And there's a bunch of different dialects of Middle English. Wycliffe's translation would fall in that. No one's saying we should read Wycliffe's translation. I mean, it's still readable as far as, like, you know, I mean, you can pick it up. People can, like, figure out what's going on. It's still English. It's a really old, much older form and a much different form of English than even the King James. If you put the King James and the Wycliffe next to each other, pretty much anyone can read the King James, obviously, and then people are going to really struggle to read the Wycliffe because it's Middle English. It's a very, very different dialect of English than the KJV. But even then, you can still make heads and tails, for the most part, of, you know, Chaucer and Wycliffe's translation. But Beowulf, it's Anglo-Saxon. Dr. Ward, it's Anglo-Saxon. It's a different language. The KJV is somewhere between Beowulf and the English of today. Beowulf's thousands of years ago. KJV's 400 years ago. What are you talking about? Wow. That's what I'm saying. Get your $6 back. Ward seems to, this is Taylor continuing, Ward seems to view himself as a modern-day Martin Luther who is saving the church from captivity to the KJV. Even saying himself, quote, I can want no other, end quote. Ward presents the case to his reader that it is a massive problem that people are reading the KJV. Even though Ward has all of the other modern options, he makes his reader believe that he has no other option for him and his kids when no such problem exists. At the end of the chapter, Ward hints that the KJV simply needs an update, which Ward graciously offered his services to TBS a while back. I remember that. At this point, Ward's reader should be skeptical. Why is Ward so motivated to retire the KJV? What is really going on here? Well, with skepticism, the skepticism they should have here, I don't think there's really an answer to give until that answer is ever made known, if it is. Man. Yeah, I mean, I highly recommend this series of articles by Reverend DeSoto, going through them. There's a lot of people that are getting caught up in this book and with Ward's videos. People who are on the fence of reading the KJV or not, who they watch these and they're like, oh, great. They're like, I'm going to watch all these and read his book. And, you know, now I finally have the answers I was looking for. No, you don't. You're just left in, you know, nowhere land, no man's land. You got nothing. He's going to tell you need to learn Greek and Hebrew. He's going to tell you, you know, to use the NIV. Like the NIV, like I think it's one of Taylor's earlier articles, he's arguing the NIV is a possible replacement for the KJV. I mean, this is like 2009, man, like 2010. Like right around the time I got saved as a Christian, it was like it came out. Like it was obvious among like when the Young Restless Reform Movement happened, what did everyone hate? The NIV and Joel Osteen. Like those were like the two things. Like to get in the club outside of being a 5-pointer or at least a 4-pointer, you had to hate the NIV and Joel Osteen. Because NIV is garbage. We all know it's garbage. It's especially the 2011 update of it, it's garbage. Just full on garbage. Because it's, you know, loosey-goosey in its translation everywhere. It, you know, changes, it takes out homosexuality, it takes out all this stuff, it's gender neutral, it's not a good Bible translation. I mean, that's obvious. You know, John MacArthur despises the NIV. You know, that's like, you know, like I said, Young Restless Reformed, I knew Calvinist 101. Get rid of your NIV and get a ESV or an NASB. So this is where this guy's going to point you to, is the NIV and to Greek and Hebrew. You know, the Christian should learn Greek and Hebrew. All right, so I guess is that not like the Muslims who think they can only read the Bible and the Quran? That's the only time it's actually truly the Word of God. The Word of Allah is if it's in the Quran or it's in the Arabic original. Well, thankfully, especially as Reformed Christians, you know that you can have the Word of God 100% accurate in a translation. That it should be 100% accurate. It should be an accurate translation from the Hebrew and Greek into English, into Spanish, into French, into whatever language. So anyway, I don't know that there's a whole lot more to say, guys. Just really weird stuff. I mentioned that in my other video. It's just weird. I don't know what you're doing here, Dr. Ward, what you're thinking. I have thoughts, but they're not nice. So anyway, thank you guys for watching. Hopefully that was helpful. Again, it was just really to get this article out here to a wider audience. It's out there. Please, if you are a TR advocate, confessional text guy, ecclesiastical text guy, canonical text guy, whatever you want to call yourself guy, use youngtexasreform.com. He's got tons of articles. He's got a bar, you know, he's got a bar at the bottom that'll navigate you to all sorts of great topics. He's covered the CBGM. Reverend DeSoto's covered, you know, arguments from James White, from Mark Ward, from really what's going on behind the scenes of textual criticism, KJV onlyism, all this kind of stuff. So, and if you're somebody who's just starting to look into this stuff, please go and actually read what's being said, not just what some scholar's telling you. All right, guys, God bless you.